Perhaps in monasteries in the West there is leisure, but outside, especially in the cities, life seems to be running at a rapid pace, like a clock, never stopping for an instant. So, if you look at life in an urban community, it seems as if every aspect of a person's life has to be so precise, designed like a screw that has to fit exactly in the hole. In some sense, you have no control over your own life. In order to survive, you have to follow this pattern and the pace that is set for you. Just like the earth, may I support beings as numerous as the sky is vast. And as long as they have not attained enlightenment, may I devote myself entirely to their happiness. When people get angry, they lose all sense of happiness. Even if they are good-looking and normally peaceful, their faces turn livid and ugly. Anger upsets their physical well-being, disturbs their rest. It destroys their appetites and makes them age prematurely. Happiness, peace, and sleep evade them, and they no longer appreciate even people who have helped them and deserve their trust and gratitude. The growth in population is very much bound up with poverty, and in turn, poverty plunders the earth. When human groups are dying of hunger, they eat everything, grass, insects, everything. They cut down the trees, they leave the land dry and bare. All other concerns vanish. That's why in the next 30 years, the problems we call environmental will be the hardest that humanity has to face. Since we have a natural compassion in us, and that compassion does manifest itself, television might be useful to awaken it. Seeing violence done to an innocent person, for example, could make us indignant, scandalize us, and in so doing help us to discover our compassion. By its very violence, television might keep us in a state of alert, yet it would also be very dangerous if its exposure to violence would lead to indifference. In fact, a central point of our teaching is how to reach non-attachment without falling into indifference and failing to cultivate compassion. For us Tibetans, a real Tibethood was born from our present difficult passage in the long history of Tibet. Centuries and centuries of rootedness can make you forget that feeling. The bonds with the earth seem secure, untouchable. Then something unexpected happens that calls those bonds into question. You discover a cynical brutality, the crushing use of force, your own weakness. Finally, you leave. You never see your country except from far away. It gets ravaged, occupied, and still you realize that it hasn't disappeared, that it subsists in you, that you still feel Tibetan. Then you begin to wonder, what does being Tibetan mean? We are afraid to die because we don't know the day nor the hour, because death can surprise us at any moment. Because we fear what comes after death, we are afraid of finding ourselves in an unknown and disagreeable place filled with anxiety. If we want to die well, we must learn to live well. The experience of death is extremely important because our state of mind at that moment can decide the quality of our future rebirth. We can, even at the moment of dying, make a special effort. In the course of dying, meditation can reach an unequaled summit, as shown by the preservation of the body in the case of the exceptional yogis. It is vital for a leader to keep in touch with the common people. I myself had learned at an early age that anyone who wishes to lead must remain close to the common people. Whether their entire life will be successful or not depends much upon the atmosphere young children feel throughout the day. In a family where there is love and compassion, the children will become happier and more successful human beings. Without love, there is a danger of spoiling or ruining their whole life. Human affection is thus most influential for children's development. Western brains work. They work a great deal, but always in the direction of efficiency. In that way, the mind puts itself at the service of the result. Like all servants, it renounces its independence. I am talking about another form of spiritual life, more detached and deeper, free from the obsession of a goal to be reached. In a way, the universal invasion of technology everywhere it goes lessens the life of the mind. If you are the sort of person who always speaks nicely in front of others but says nasty things about them behind their backs, of course nobody will like you. There is a true feminist movement in Buddhism that relates to the goddess Tara. Following her cultivation of bodhicitta, the altruistic motivation to attain enlightenment for the sake of others, she looked on those striving toward full awakening, and she felt that there were too few people who attained Buddhahood as women. So she vowed, "I have developed bodhicitta as a woman. For all of my lifetimes along the path, I vow to be born as a woman, and in my final lifetime when I attain Buddhahood, then too I will be a woman." The metaphor of light is a common image in all the major religious traditions. In the Buddhist context, light is particularly associated with wisdom and knowledge. Darkness is associated with ignorance and a state of misknowledge. This corresponds to the two aspects of the path. There is the method aspect, which includes such practices as compassion and tolerance, and the wisdom or knowledge aspect, the insight penetrating the nature of reality. It is the knowledge or wisdom aspect of the path that is the true antidote to dispelling ignorance. An area in Tibetan Buddhism which may be of interest to scientists is the relationship between the physical elements and the nerves, in particular the relationship between the elements in the brain and consciousness. Involved here are the changes in consciousness, happy or unhappy states of mind, and so forth, the kind of effect they have on the elements within the brain, and the consequent effect that it has on the body. Certain physical illnesses, for example, improve or worsen according to the state of mind. All the waters and rivers of different lands and climes have their ultimate meeting point in the ocean. So, too, the differing viewpoints on society, the variety of economic theories, and the means to their attainment benefit mankind itself. There is no point in indulging in dissension, creating discussions on differing ideologies. No positive result has accrued from attempting to convert all men of different temperaments and likings into one common ideology and mode of behavior. This can clearly be seen from the contemporary history of both the East and the West. Make efforts to consider as transitory all adverse circumstances and disturbances. Like ripples in a pool, they occur and soon disappear. Insofar as our lives are karmically conditioned, they are characterized by endless cycles of problems. One problem appears and passes, and soon another one begins. The Buddha advised us, "O bhikshus and wise men, just as a goldsmith buys his gold only after testing by burning, cutting, and rubbing, so you must accept my words only after careful examination, and not merely out of reverence for me." Wise parents, without any anger, may sometimes scold or even punish their children. This is permissible. But if you really get angry and whack the child too much, then you will feel regret in the future. However, with a good motivation of seeking a child's welfare, it is possible to display an expression appropriate to what the child needs at that moment. Exile has helped me. When, at some point in our lives, we meet a real tragedy, which could happen to any one of us, we can react in two ways. Obviously, we can lose hope, let ourselves slip into discouragement, into alcohol, drugs, and unending sadness. Or else we can wake ourselves up, discover in ourselves an energy that was hidden there, and act with more clarity, more force.